Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Kia ora koutou, ko Julie Ferry tuku ingoa, ko pukitapapa pukiwiwi te maunga, ko te awanga te awa, ko manukau te whanga. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora, my name's Julie Ferry. I'm the Deputy Chair of the Pukitapapa Local Board and one of five Roskill Community Roskill Community Voice Reps on that board of Auckland Council. I'm also part of the City Vision Centre-Left Whānau, a group of progressive politicians working towards things like better housing and transport and sustainability. I have a regular spot on Red Alert Radio and I'm very keen to get your feedback. You can find me pretty easily on social media once you know how to spell my tricky last name. I'm on both Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Julie Ferry. That's spelled F for Fred, A-I-R-E-Y. And we also have a Red Alert Radio Facebook page. If you search for Red Alert Radio AKL, you should find us. We put up links to these shows as podcasts once they're up online, as well as other background information about the topics we cover, the people we talk to, that kind of thing. Sometimes there's even some photos. And you can get all of our past shows on the Red Alert Radio archive on planetaudio.org.nz as well. Today, I'm talking with Olivia Paulson, one of the conveners of Mums for Refugees. Olivia is a lawyer in her day job and reasonably recently moved back to Auckland from living in Australia, where she first got involved in refugee issues. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. First up, a little bit of an introduction about Mums for Refugees. What do you do?
So we're essentially a grassroots network of mums from across Australia and now New Zealand who are advocating for better treatment of asylum seekers and refugees, better asylum seeker and refugee policies, and providing support and friendship to refugees and asylum seekers in communities. We've got working groups in all the major Australian cities, and we've recently started a New Zealand working group. And we've got a Facebook page with an audience of about 36,000 that
Wow.
we use to promote. Yeah,
it's big.
Yep. It's pretty good. Yeah, and that's pretty active. And we use that just, I guess, to get the message out about refugee issues.
And how did it start up? What motivated you to start getting involved?
So in terms of the original Mums for Refugees, like all great social change movements, it started on Facebook.
Yeah.
It was driven out of a group of Inner West mums.
In Sydney.
In Sydney.
Yeah.
Who were just really, in late 2014, really appalled with what was going on in Australian asylum seeker policy, particularly the reopening of the camps on Manus and Nauru, and wanted to do something about it. And I guess while juggling parenting and other jobs, we're just looking for a way to make a difference. So started meeting and it's really just grown from there. I got involved in mid-September 2015. I'd moved to Sydney in 2014 and had a next-door neighbour who was a regular visitor to the Villawood Detention Centre.
Yeah.
So I got talking to him about what was going on in Australian asylum seeker policy. And originally, to be honest, thought he must have been exaggerating, but, you know, found out more and thought, look, I've got to, you know, do something about this. And then not long after that, Alan Kurdi washed up on a beach in the Mediterranean.
Yes.
And there was a lot of media attention, and I came across a post from this group called Mums for Refugees and thought, hello, this is,
yeah,
you know,
this is what you want to do.
This is where I fit in, I think, yeah. And from there, it was initially more casually involved in the group. I guess the turning point for me was when someone posted in the group asking if someone could help transport a mum and her six children to visit their father who'd been in the detention centre and had been in hospital, who'd hurt himself. I offered, and I over time became friends with that mum. I visited her. Her kids played with my kids. I helped her visit her husband again in hospital and detention centres. You know, just drank cups of tea, kids played. And then one morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, police officers turned up at her house and took her and her six children to the detention centre. And 2 weeks later, she and the children were deported. Her husband was left behind because he had tried to kill himself again. And nobody's heard from her since. And for me, that was sort of the point of no return. I thought, I can't stand by while a country like Australia is letting things like this happen to young families.
That sounds really harsh. Yeah. Where were they from?
So he was from a Middle Eastern country and was a and had left for political reasons. She was not a citizen in that country, but she was sent back to that country because that's where they'd left from.
Right. Wow.
So, yeah, a woman with six children in a Middle Eastern country and no husband.
Yeah, on her own. Mm. And having already had to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's really harsh. Mm. How long ago was that?
That was in 2015.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So when you started working on these issues in Australia, and we've sort of touched on this a little bit, immigration there is treated quite, not super differently from here in New Zealand. Unfortunately, there's an undercurrent of racism here too. But what do you think it is about what looks like, from a New Zealand perspective, quite an extreme overreaction that they have in Australia, particularly to refugee and asylum seekers, who are effectively people who are vulnerable, persecuted, in danger, then seeking to go to another country to be safe? It just seems to me a real disconnect that, you know, you have a relatively small number of people in the bigger picture of immigration who are coming to be safe, and yet there seems to in Australia be such a negative reaction to that. Do you have any insights from living there?
Look, it is something that still baffles me. I think at its heart it is driven by fear and driven by an incredibly strong rhetoric around stopping the boat and stopping deaths at sea and, you know, all this talk about, you know, the evil of people smugglers.
Yeah.
And I think that political rhetoric has been incredibly pervasive, and also it has bipartisan support. You know, both major political parties support offshore detention, and in that sort of environment and without a strong public voice for change, you know, these policies just keep going and going and getting harder and harder.
And there's one of the things I've heard people say is about how refugees and asylum seekers are queue jumpers.
Yes.
Which I just sort of like, yeah, well, if someone was trying to kill me or my family or put us in prison, then actually I don't think it's unreasonable to expect to be processed a bit faster than if I'm moving because I've got a better job or I like the weather better, you know?
Yeah.
So any idea where that sort of, that really visceral, oh, I can't let someone get in front of some mythical other person, not even myself because I'm already a citizen, yeah, or a resident. Where do you think that might come from?
I think that's right, and I think there's a lot of misconceptions around that. I think even when people talk about queue jumpers, and some of the politicians in Australia talk about that too, and
yeah,
they say, you know, there's all these people in, you know, refugee camps in other parts of the world who've done it the, you know, right way.
Yeah.
And they're waiting their turn, and as you say, these people are queue jumping. But I think, like you, I think, you know, if I was there with my children in a country where I thought they might be seriously harmed or killed,
yeah,
I'd be doing what I could to get them out too. But also for a lot of these people, and the people that are on Manus and Nauru, you know, they don't necessarily come from war zones. They don't come from places where doing it that sort of pseudo right way is, you know, even an option. You know, they're homosexual people from Arabic countries. They're religious converts. They're people who've said the wrong thing politically. They're journalists, you know, and none of those, you know, there's just not even that avenue for people like that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's something I hadn't realised. Mm. In thinking about it, yeah, what is the pathway if you are in a country where there isn't already some kind of intervention, mm, around refugee support?
Yeah.
Sounds like there isn't really one.
No, not really. I think you've just got to get yourself out, and, you know, and fundamentally too, you know, we have signed up to the UN Convention, Australia signed up to the UN Convention, and that convention says that people who are at risk of persecution have a right to seek asylum in signatory countries. So this sort of rhetoric that people are doing something illegal is, yeah, just wrong. You know, we've agreed at an international law level that it's something people have a right to do.
Yeah. Do you think some of it's about race?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it often is. I think particularly now, that fear of, you know, of people from Middle Eastern countries and the rhetoric, yeah, that people from the Middle East are terrorists, and if they're running away, you know, they're putting I think a couple of years ago there was a lot of talk about terrorists coming on boats, and,
yeah,
everyone on Manus and Nauru might be terrorists. But actually, also, when you look at the people on Manus and Nauru, those people have had refugee status determinations, most of them now.
Right.
There, so they've been through that process. Their claims have been found to be genuine.
Right, yeah, but they're still in a detention.
They're still in a detention centre on a small Pacific island.
Yeah, which isn't particularly well equipped to deal with them. And So, and that must have a huge impact too on the actual population of that island as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. There is a lot of tension between the refugee populations on Nauru and Manus and the local community, and it's understandable. I mean, these are small and under-resourced countries. You know, the entire country of Nauru is approximately the same land area as Melbourne Airport.
Wow, just the airport.
Yeah, the airport including its land holding. But
Yeah. And so, and I imagine I guess there's a certain irony there, which, you know, not a good thing, but you've got a large country with a relatively large amount of space that's saying to small Pacific nations, we're concerned about basically bringing in lots of people of different races who haven't necessarily gone through the polite way. And we're going to get you to take these very diverse groups of people, some of whom will, I imagine, be very traumatised.
Yes.
And have some quite specific, particularly mental health needs. But they're a really diverse group because they've come from a lot of different places around the world. And we're going to put them in your small island, your small space, which then is probably quite monocultural as well in terms of the existing population. And you can deal with that for us. Thanks very much.
That's right. And also these are countries that are quite reliant on Australia for aid, just for fundamental services, you know. Yeah. And so when, you know, Australia says to Nauru, if you do that, we'll build you a better hospital and we'll build you a better school.
Yeah.
It's not a... the balance of power is not equal in those discussions, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one of the things we've sort of talked about there about Australia's racism, and I've sort of had in the back of my mind too, I reasonably recently as an adult read John Marsden's series Tomorrow When the War Began, and thinking about the role of that, which is, you know, hugely widely read among people of our generation who would have, you know, and I'm in my 40s, listeners, who would have, Olivia's probably a bit younger, I reckon.
Much younger.
Yeah, there we go. Who would have read that in their teen years. And that is about an experience of invasion.
Yep.
And my recollection is that they don't explicitly make it clear that it is an Asian country who has invaded, but that's the subtext. There's a lot of stuff there about people looking different and people speaking a different language and things like that. And of course we go back to you know, the domino theory after World War II, and you know, the very real fear during World War II of invasion through, you know, by Japan as well. And I sort of wonder if some of that plays a role in a little bit like how the Simpsons episode about the monorail means no one's ever going to build a monorail again. You know, that sort of pop culture discussion through John Marsden's books, and I imagine he never intended this, has sort of got a generation of people who have that fear of invasion and fear of the other that, you know, it's not as common here in New Zealand. We feel sort of further away geographically.
I think that's right. And I think we don't have those same harsh policies, but we also have never really been put in a position of having to test what we would do and how we would respond if significant numbers of people started turning up in New Zealand by boat.
Yeah.
So while it's easy to say, we'd never do that, we're much better, there's some questions there, you know, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, and, I mean, we did have, under the last government, there were some... I remember at one stage the former Prime Minister John Key said that there were some people who were coming here by boat, and there was a lot of dispute about whether that was accurate, and also whether people who, you know, might have set out to get to New Zealand by boat were going to get here anyway, you know.
That's right. And recently, coincidentally, while a lot of the talk was going on about whether New Zealand would take some of the men from Manus when the when the detention centre was there was closed, suddenly, Peter Dutton, the Australian Immigration Minister, piped up and said, oh, we've turned round boats that were headed for New Zealand. And you did see the New Zealand reaction, and it wasn't one of great acceptance, it has to be said. I think some of that underlying, as you say, invasion fear and fear of change probably too, and fear of cultural change is very much, I think, still existing here.
And it was something actually that came through in the submissions around the long-term plan, around discussions around the housing issue. I spoke at a forum recently on housing, and there were questions around immigration and the idea that Auckland in particular is full, so we should shut the doors. And, I mean, my response to that was, we don't have a door.
Yeah.
We can't shut the door for a start. You know, there's a practical thing there. But also a lot of our population increases, actually. New Zealanders returning, people having children, people living longer. So it's, you know, it's more complicated than just immigration.
And when people say shut the doors, I'm sure they also still believe that that shouldn't apply if they had family themselves who they might like to come and live here with them.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's a very selective door shutting often.
Yes. And that's, you know, and there is a perception that the biggest groups of migrants are, for example, from China, when actually... until quite recently, the biggest group of migrants in New Zealand were actually coming from Britain.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah. So that, I guess that's sort of something I wanted to explore a little bit with you in terms of, you know, we look at Australia and go, oh, gosh, they're really racist over there. But we don't actually have the best track record either. And you know, do you think we can sort of rest on our laurels in that space?
Is the short answer. I don't think we can rest on our laurels. I don't... my perception is we are not sort of as bad as Australia, but there's certainly a lot more we can do. I mean, we're in a world, in a region where I'd say we're not pulling our weight. You know, and in Indonesia at the moment, there's 14,000 refugees and asylum seekers.
Waiting.
Yes. Well, Indonesia's not a signatory country to the UN Convention. And, you know, we take 1,500 a year, and our processing times are slow. We take very small numbers from certain parts of the world, which again goes back to that sort of racist undercurrent. But I think, you know, we are a pretty strong voice in this region, and I think we need to be doing more to be working towards a Pacific solution that's a genuine response. You know, it's all very well to say to stop the boats, but these aren't people that are coming here on holiday. They're people that can't stay in the country they're from. So you're not solving a problem if you stop the boats without a proper solution. You're just making it someone else's problem.
Yeah, and possibly resulting in more deaths.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the no deaths at sea is all very well, but if people aren't safe on land...
Yeah. So you mentioned there the Pacific, and it sounds to me from our conversation so far and what I know of the work that... the refugees you work with are generally not people who are coming from a climate change situation. Is that sort of something you see much of? So we are having, you know, there are conversations about some of the Pacific Islands with rising sea levels won't have much arable land, won't necessarily be able to support their populations. Do you deal with any people coming in those circumstances yet?
Not yet. And also I think one of the things particularly, we don't have a huge on-the-ground community contact presence in New Zealand yet.
Yeah,
in Australia we do. There's a lot more direct contact. But also often the people that groups like Mums for Refugees tend to get involved with are not the ones who are coming under you know, pre-approved UN schemes and have their visas and, you know, coming, you know, like the New Zealand set intakes. And the people that come on those intakes generally, in Australia and New Zealand, are pretty well supported. They're pretty, you know, the resettlement centre in Mangere does a pretty good job of resettling people. So the people we tend to support more are people who might, you know, arrive and seek asylum. And, you know, in Australia, they're the people who come by boat and are on bridging visas or in community detention. There's sort of more...
Yeah,
the people who fall through those cracks a bit because, you know, going back to our conversation earlier, they haven't quite done things, I guess, you know, the right way.
Yeah. And so in New Zealand, that sort of probably tends to be someone who comes on a holiday visa or and then
holiday
stays.
Visas or student visas or and stays. There are people who travel through to Australia and New Zealand on forged documents still.
Yeah.
Because that's a way of getting out of some countries where it wouldn't otherwise be possible, particularly places like China.
Yeah.
Yeah. so that whole range of ways. But, yeah.
I just can't imagine being in a country where I was already, you know, under suspicion or vulnerable, and then trying to get forged documents for myself and my children. You know, that would be so dangerous and stressful and uncertain.
Yeah, incredibly. Yeah. That's right. Incredibly dangerous. Incredibly, you're incredibly vulnerable. It's incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an easy option. It's not a let's sneak around the system and get a better life. It's you have to be pretty desperate to be exploring those sort of avenues, I think.
Absolutely. So what has surprised you about doing this work?
I think, look, I never stop being surprised and horrified in particularly the Australian context about some of the stuff that goes on in these offshore centres, as well as working with Mums for Refugees. In my legal capacity, I did some volunteer work with a group called the National Justice Project, who are a human rights law firm and do a lot of work for people on Manus and Nauru, primarily around getting them healthcare. You know, we've acted for a pregnant woman with a breech baby and preeclampsia who the Australian government wouldn't transfer to Australia, for suicidal 10-year-old children, for children with significant learning delays, for people with serious heart issues. And it just, it never stops to amaze me that people who've already been through that much and are so sick, and especially, you know, when you're talking pregnant women and children, that the compassion there just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
On a more positive note, I think I'm constantly surprised and amazed by, you know, the generosity and the grace and the humour of people that I meet who've been through these experiences, and also how much they love Australia and New Zealand when they get here. You know, even talking to Australian people in Australia who've been on Manus and Nauru, who've been in detention centres, and they just will say, but Australian people are so amazing. You know, the people we meet here are so great. Everyone's so welcoming. It's such a great place. You know, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm safe.
Yeah. So they feel lucky.
They feel lucky, yeah.
Yeah, in the lucky country.
It's humbling, yeah.
Yeah. So what are the, and what are the common misconceptions that you come across? We've sort of possibly talked a little bit about some of them, but when people you're encountering in other parts of your life find out you're doing this sort of stuff, what do they often seem to misunderstand about it?
I think the biggest one is that kind of conception or belief that people are queue jumpers.
Yeah.
That they're doing it, that this wouldn't have happened if they'd done it the right way.
Right.
And that, you know, everyone who's a refugee has come from a war zone and can find their way to a UN processing centre and go through those channels. Also, that, you know, all refugees come from war zones, all refugees are Muslim.
Right.
You know, a lot of the people I know on Manus and Nauru are actually Christians, people who've converted from Islam to Christianity, and often combined with political issues, you know, and have become, you know, they're deemed apostates, and it's unsafe to still be in a lot of those countries.
Yeah.
I think the refugee experience is far more diverse than a lot of people realise.
And so, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is because Mount Roskill, the area I work in and represent, used to be one of the main settlement points for refugees, asylum seekers. So it's something I'm quite interested in. We have a number of organisations locally that work on those issues. They're now primarily being settled outside of Auckland, of course.
Yeah.
But one of the best parts of my day job is citizenship ceremonies.
Mm.
And you will sometimes see people who you're pretty sure this person's come through the refugee route. So not so much now, but when I first started going to them about 7 years ago, you would see young men sort of in their mid to late teens who were on their own, not in a family group, and clearly from Somalia.
Yep.
And it was really sobering to think, and they were just so happy as well, to be getting citizenship. It was really sobering to think that some of these guys would have been former child soldiers in that situation. And, you know, we do have a lot of refugees in our community. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to to talk to you. People who've, in fact, I was talking to someone last night at an event who had come through that pathway and had come from Somalia. But what are some of the other countries that people are coming from when that's not a war zone issue?
So I think you still see some of them there. A lot from Middle Eastern countries. Iran, there are quite a few Iranians on Manus and Nauru. Afghani people, but also, you know, in Australia, there's Chinese refugees. There's a whole diverse range of experiences, depending on your reasons for seeking asylum, I think.
Yeah. And I just thought of right now, I've been watching The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes.
I don't know if you've seen it, but it's quite interesting there, the way that they portray the refugee experience for people escaping Gilead, which is like a fundamentalist Christian approach to the United States, yep, into Canada. And that's, I think that's hopefully a real eye-opener for a lot of people about, you know, the efforts involved in getting there and then the trauma of dealing with that as well. I don't know if you've seen those episodes yet. But
no, I haven't, but I've read the book.
Yeah, they're pretty hard to watch. The whole thing's hard to watch, but yeah.
I think also it's interesting, you know, you made the comment that a lot of people you see are young men, and that's another thing that people sort of comment on and say, oh, how, you know, why is it, if it's a genuine thing and if everyone's at risk, why is it all these men? Why are they leaving their families behind? And I think it's important, you know, to remember that that experience of seeking asylum is not a safe one,
yep,
and even more so for women and children. You know, this,
yeah,
often it is a case of people taking a desperate decision and thinking, well, if we get one of us safe, then maybe they can bring the rest of the family. So people are, you know, separated from families and worrying about families who are still
behind
and, you know, in really difficult and dangerous situations.
And, you know, when people are migrating between countries and you know, just for economic reasons, or, you know, they decided to move for whatever reason, not in a in a stressful situation, it's quite common to send the male family member first,
yep,
to get things set up, and then for other family members to follow afterwards. But when it's refugees, for some reason people are sort of suspicious.
And it's a horrible risk and a horrible decision to make, but if you're faced with a situation where the only way to safety is getting on one of the, I don't know if you've seen some of these boats that people come on, they're not scary. You know, imagine
it's
the fear of doing
yacht
that as an adult. Imagine getting, you know, putting your baby or your 2-year-old child on one of those boats.
Yeah, absolutely. So just as we come to the end, how can people get involved? How can they help out and find out more about Mums for Refugees?
So the easiest way to find us is through Facebook. If you look up Mums for Refugees on Facebook, you'll find our page.
And that's the number four.
Yeah.
Yep.
Or also if you hunt for Mums for Refugees New Zealand Working Group, that should come up. And if you're a mum, we'd love you to join our working group.
Great.
Or, you know, of course, everyone's welcome to follow us and see what's going on Facebook. Send us an email. I mean, there's all sorts of things going on. I think one of the things about being a grassroots group is we're united by a set of common values, but people can get involved in the way that works for them and do the things that are meaningful for them, whether it's that they want to help support some of the families on Nauru or the men on Manus who need some material aid sent to them, whether you want to go to rallies, whether you want to, you know, advocate for change in a political arena. There's, you know, there's options, and
great,
it's really it's driven by, you know, what members want to do, I think, as much as anything.
Fantastic.
And what they have time to do, because, you know, we're all
busy
mum.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That's really interesting, Olivia, and I've certainly learned a lot from our chat today. I hope you have too, listeners. Thanks for listening in, and a reminder, you can listen back to this interview or any of our back catalogue on planetaudio.org.nz. We're under R for Red Alert Radio in the programs list. This has been Julie Ferry for Red Alert Radio. Ka kite anō.
Get together next week at 9:05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.